Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Demons and Deception, Part 2. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight.
Diabolical forces are formidable. These forces are eternal and they exist today. The fairy tale is true. The devil exists, God exists, and for us, as a people, our destiny hinges upon which one we elect to follow. Ed Warren.
First, this bulletin from the WOR newsroom. 6 members of one family have been found shot to death in their night clothes in their expensive home in Amityville, Long Island. The only available information at this moment, according to the Amityville Village Police, is that the victims have been identified as members of the DeFeo family. They were found by a 23-year-old son, Ronald DeFeo, who is believed to be the only surviving member of the family. 6 members of the family found shot to death in their home in Amityville, Long Island. We will have further details on the 11 o'clock news.
The day of Tuesday, the 12th of November, 1974, was like every other in Amityville, Long Island. Affluent and blissful beauty. Nothing stood out as being particularly different or unusual. That evening, the DeFeo family sat down together for dinner as they always did. It was a calm and quiet evening in the DeFeo house. Mark was recovering from a football injury, so was laid up on the couch watching television. John Matthew and Louise joined him. All the family were dressed in their nightclothes and in bed by 11:30 p.m. Ronnie, the eldest son of the DeFeo family, sat in the second floor television room watching a war movie titled Castle Keep, the one based on the novel by William Eastlake and starring Burt Lancaster and Patrick O'Neill. The movie had a particularly violent ending, at least by the standards of 1974. It's known that Ronnie had been drinking and shooting heroin that night. He has admitted that much since. Ronnie fell asleep in the armchair as the movie came to an end. When Ron Jr. awoke in the morning, he used the bathroom, then headed straight to work, arriving at the Brigante Buick dealership at 7 a.m. The car dealership was on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, around 39 miles away, which would have taken around 45 minutes to drive to back then. As I previously stated, the dealership was owned by Michael Brigante Sr., Ronnie's grandfather, and managed by Ronald Sr., Ronnie's dad. Big Ronald Sr. didn't show up for work that day, but this wasn't out of character for him. Big Ron often went away on business, and he didn't always let his staff know. At 11 a.m, Ronnie called his girlfriend, Mindy Weiss. The pair had only met 6 months earlier, and they'd had a shotgun romance. No pun intended. Ronnie had told her that he was leaving work early that day, and he wanted to come and see her. Weiss lived on Harbour Lane East in Massapequa. Ronnie left work at around 12 p.m. and headed over to Mindy's house. Her place was only around 3 miles from his on Ocean Drive. While driving to her house, Ronnie headed down County Line Road, where he drove past his best friend, Bobby Kelski, who was driving in the opposite direction. Now, Kelski was a 25-year-old guy whose most recent job was working as a stonemason at his father's masonry business. Kelski was also a former high school football star when he entered Amityville High School, the same place where he had met Ronnie. On this day, when he saw Ronnie, he was between jobs. Kelski frequently socialized and drank with Ronnie and a few other friends at the local town bar. As soon as they saw each other, they stopped their cars, turned around and pulled over to see each other. Kelski and Ronnie spoke for a short while, then made plans to meet up at their regular local bar later that night. Ronnie arrived at Mindy's house at 1 p.m. that afternoon, where he picked her up and they both headed to the Sunrise Mall in Massapequa to do some Christmas shopping. Ronnie made it a point to tell Mindy that no one at his house was answering the telephone. Ronnie said this was strange, and this wasn't normal. Mindy later said that she felt Ronnie came out with this abruptly and out of the blue. Ronnie made a point of asking Mindy to accompany him to a payphone, where he called his house in front of her. There was still no answer. Ronnie and Mindy then went to pick up and inject heroin. A few hours later, Ronnie headed to Bobby Kelski's house. His plan was to hang out with Kelski before heading back to Mindy's place for a date that they had arranged at 7:30 p.m. Ronnie made it a point to tell Bobby that he was concerned about his family because they weren't answering the telephone. Although, how concerned could he have really been because he didn't head home to check on them at this point? Ronnie was a regular at a local dive bar called Henry's. It was located at 181 Merrick Road, just a quarter mile down the street from Ocean Avenue where he lived. The locals nicknamed the bar the Witch's Brew, something that is so fitting for this story, don't you think? Ronnie walked into Henry's bar at 4 p.m. on November the 13th, 1974, as per witnesses and bartender John Wendell. He sat at the bar and ordered a vodka with 7-Up and a lemon peel. This was his regular order. Ronnie ordered 4 more of the same drink and then left. At just after 6 p.m, Ronnie returned to Henry's bar. He flung open the bar door, spotted his friend Bobby Kelski and ran toward him, flustered and upset. "Bobby, you've got to help me," Ronnie shouted. "I think my mother and father are shot." Ronnie fell to his knees and began crying hysterically. Kelski rushed to Ronnie's aid. "Bobby, you've got to help me. Somebody shot my mother and father," Ronnie repeated. "Are you sure they're not asleep?" Bobby replied. "No, I saw them up there," Ronnie said, rushed and frantic. "Come on then, let's go," Bobby said immediately. This all caused quite the scene in Henry's bar and caught the attention of a number of other regulars. The owner of Henry's bar, William Scodamaglia, and regular patrons John Altieri, Al Saxton, Joseph Resthwaite, Bobby Kelski and Ronnie all raced over to the DeFeo house. When they arrived at the house, Shaggy, the DeFeo family sheepdog, was barking wildly and extremely agitated. The dog was tied to the kitchen door, inside of the house, a regular practice that Big Ron did every night before heading to bed. Not considered particularly acceptable by today's standards. Ronnie had lost his keys and had to break a window to enter the property. "Be careful," Al Saxton said to Ronnie, his voice trembling a little. "Somebody might be in there." "I don't care," Bobby said back. Ronnie opened the door and they all proceeded into the house. The men headed inside. Except for Ronnie, he remained at the front door. Bobby ran up the stairs to the master bedroom. He had been in the DeFeo house dozens of times and knew it like his own. The master bedroom was upstairs on the first floor, or second to my American listeners. So Bobby ran up the stairs. At the top of the stairs, Bobby immediately noticed a weird smell. He peered into the dark room, but he couldn't see anything. It was pitch black. so he turned on the lights. There, right in front of him, to Bobby's horror, was Big Ron, lying on his stomach with a large bullet hole in his back and a blood trail running down the side of his stomach, pooling on the bed. Louise was lying next to him, also face down on his stomach, but was covered with an orange blanket. She was still, not breathing, motionless. Bobby assumed that she had been shot too, he later said. Bobby felt sick at the sight, and his legs turned to jelly. He felt faint, and the other men ran up the stairs to his aid, helping him down. John Altieri searched the rest of the rooms upstairs. He discovered the bodies of Mark and John Matthew, both face down, motionless, with large bullet holes in their back and pools of blood surrounding them on their beds. Altieri rushed downstairs and told the other men what he had seen. Ronnie was crying hysterically outside and banging his fist on the car. "Who do you want me to call from your family?" Bobby asked, placing his hand on Ronnie's back. Ronnie asked Bobby to call his grandfather, Michael Brigante. He would know what to do. Bobby rushed back into the house to use the phone, but he noticed that one of the other men had already taken it. Joe Yeswhite, in the meantime, was using the kitchen phone to make a desperate call to the police. Yeswhite dialed 911. The call was placed at exactly 6:30 p.m. The actual call hasn't been released by the authorities in its true audio format, though Suffolk County Police have released a written account of it. We have used the exact written account to recreate the call here using AI. Whilst it's not the greatest, you get the idea.
"This is Suffolk County Police. May I help you?"
"We have a shooting here. DeFeo."
"Sir, what is your name?"
"Joey Yeswhite."
"Can you spell that?"
"Yeah. Yeswhit."
"Y-E-S."
"Yeswhit."
"UIT. Your phone number?"
"I don't even know if it's here. I don't have a phone number here."
"Okay. Where are you calling from?"
"It's in Amityville. Call up the Amityville police. And it's right off, Ocean Avenue in Amityville."
"Austin?"
"Ocean Avenue. What the..."
"Ocean Avenue? Off of where?"
"It's right off Merrick Road. Ocean Avenue."
"Merrick Road. What's the problem, sir?"
"It's a shooting."
"There's a shooting. Anybody hurt?"
"Huh?"
"Anybody hurt?"
"Yeah, it's everybody's dead."
"What do you mean, everybody's dead?"
"I don't know what happened. Kid come running in the bar. He says everybody in the family was killed, and we came down here."
"Hold on a second, sir."
"Hello. What's your name?"
"My name is Joe Yeswhite."
"George Edwards?"
"Joe Yeswhite."
"How do you spell it?"
"What? How many times do I have to tell you? Yeswhite."
"Where are you at?"
"I'm on Ocean Avenue."
"What number?"
"I don't even know that." "In Amityville. Call up the Amityville police and have someone come down here. They know the family."
"Okay, now, tell me what's wrong."
"I don't know. Guy come running in the bar and said there his mother and father are shot. We ran down to his house, and everybody in the house is shot. I don't know how long, you know. So,
What's the address of the house?"
"Hold on. Let me go look up the number." "All right, hold on. 112 Ocean Avenue, Amityville."
"Is that Amityville or North Amityville?"
"Yes, Amityville. Right on south of Merrick Road."
"Is it right in the village limits?"
"It's in the village limits, yeah."
"All right, where are you calling from? Public phone?"
"No, I'm calling right from the house, because I don't see a number on the phone."
"You're at the house itself?"
"Yeah."
"How many bodies are there?"
I think they said 4.
"There's 4?
"Yeah."
"All right, you stay right there at the house, and I'll call the Amityville Village PD, and they'll come down."
Anyway, moments after the call ended, the county dispatcher contacted Sergeant William Smith at the Amityville Police Department and relayed the multiple homicides. Sergeant Smith then radioed police officer Kenneth Groguski, who was already in the Amityville area. Groguski sped over to Ocean Avenue, and within minutes, he had pulled up in front of the house. Ronnie and the other men from Henry's bar were stood in the doorway, visibly shaken, when Gregorski arrived. Officer Gregorski arrived at 6:40 p.m. Ronnie was hysterical, crying and creating quite the show of emotion. His whole family had been killed, I suppose. "My mother and father are dead," he screamed to the officer. Gregorski entered the house and ran up the stairs with his gun drawn. The officer found Mr. and Mrs. DeFeo in the master bedroom. He then headed to the next bedroom along the upstairs corridor. It was the boys' bedroom. Their bodies were lying in pools of their own blood. Gregorski rushed down the stairs and called the Amityville Police Department headquarters. "Sergeant, I have four bodies, a mother and a father, and two boys," he said. Ronnie was sat at the kitchen table, still inconsolable with tears flooding down his face. In between sobs, Ronnie said, "I also have two sisters." Officer Edwin Tyndall of the Amityville PD pulled up. Gregorski dropped the phone and asked Tyndall to follow him. The two police officers headed upstairs together. When they returned, they confirmed that they had also found the bodies of Allison and Dawn. Again, both lay in face down on their beds, both shot dead, with bullet holes in their backs. Allison was in her room, and Dawn in the third floor attic bedroom. "I found two more bodies of young females," Gregorski reported to police headquarters. The murders were the worst the quiet town of Amityville had ever seen. Neighbors slowly began to congregate outside the house as more and more police cars arrived at the scene. It quickly transpired that the children, Mark, John Matthew, Allison and Dawn, had each been killed by single gunshots, while the parents had received two shots apiece. The police later announced that physical evidence established that Louise DeFeo and 13-year-old Allison were both awake at the time of their killing. Almost immediately, the nature of the sixth death seemed strange to the police. Why had none of the victims woken up when the others were shot? Why were they all laid face down? Within 5 minutes, Amityville's police detective Pat Comerato arrived at the scene. Police Chief William Kay was attending a police association meeting that was some 30 miles away when he got the call. He rushed to the scene in Amityville as quick as he could. The police interviewed the neighbors in the immediate vicinity, and no one had heard any gunshots. Evidence collated from the scene by forensic officers identified a .35 caliber Marlin rifle as the murder weapon, although the whereabouts of the weapon was unknown. At 7:20 p.m., Suffolk County Homicide Squad arrived at the scene. Among them were Lieutenant Tom Richmond, Detective Sergeant James Bariski, and Chief Detective George Harrison. No, not that George Harrison. A statue of the Virgin Mary stood on the front lawn looking down on the swarms of police flooding into the crime scene. Suffolk County Detective Gaspar Randazzo began to question Ronnie at the kitchen table. Randazzo asked Ronnie who he thinks committed the murders. Ronnie immediately and without hesitation replied, "Tony Mazzeo." Mazzeo was a notorious mafia hitman who was also a good friend to the DeFeo family. Remember those mob ties we mentioned in episode 1? Well, Mazzeo had spent a brief time living with the DeFeo family back in 1971. Ronnie told Detective Randazzo that he and Mazzeo had gotten into a big fight a few years previously, so he suspected that Mazzeo probably killed his family as revenge. Which made absolutely no sense whatsoever. Why would Mazzeo wait 3 years to exact revenge if that was the case? Also, why would he kill Ronnie's family? He was close to them, and had only quarrelled with Ronnie, not the others. They had taken him in. In fact, Mazzeo had a better relationship with other family members than he did with Ronnie, so it makes no sense at all. If he wanted revenge, he would have just killed Ronnie, surely. Also, and this is something that Detective Randazzo thought while questioning Ronnie, although didn't say it to Ronnie at the time, the Mafia had a code about not hurting or killing young children. It was one of their honor codes, so there is no way Mazzeo would have shot the kids if this was a revenge attack. The shooting was also very clearly not executed in the style of a mafia hit, which were all fairly uniform and immediately identifiable to detective investigators. Firstly, real life wasn't like the movies, and most mafia hits were carried out with knives and not guns. A slit throat, for example, or a blade to the base of the brain. But if a gun had to be used, then it was almost always a pistol, and usually with silencer rather than a shotgun or high-powered rifle, which had been used here. Remember, the Mafia don't want to bring heat or attention down upon themselves. It's all business. Secondly, if it was a Mafia hit, it would be highly unlikely that the bodies would have been left at the scene. The Mafia found it far more beneficial if people just disappeared. No body, no crime. So to leave six bodies at a crime scene would be very out of character for them. It was clear to Detective Randazzo that this was no Mafia hit. Still, he humoured Ronnie and did a check on Tony Mazzeo, who, as it turns out, had a really solid alibi for the night of the murders, and one that the police could easily verify. Rufus Ireland, who lived next door, was watching the commotion outside from his office, which was at the front of his house. Al Saxton, one of the men who had rushed to the DeFeo house with Ronnie from Henry's Bar, was a friend of Ireland's, and he burst into the house exclaiming, "Rufus, I've got to tell you. You're not going to believe this. Everybody next door is dead." Following just behind Saxton was Detective Harrison, who entered Ireland's house and asked him if the police could use his home as a temporary headquarters for police and medics, to which Ireland immediately agreed. With that, the police announced that they needed everyone out of the DeFeo house, as it was now a crime scene, and taped the entire home off for forensics. Everyone moved across to Ireland's house next door. During all of the commotion and police presence, Bobby had called Ronnie's grandfather, who rushed over to the house. Michael Brucante turned up wearing a gun on his waist, which the police made a silent note of. Ronnie was placed into quote-unquote protective custody.
Today, police combed the DeFeo's handsome three-story house for clues while divers explored the backyard swimming pool for the still unfound murder weapon. Police have been questioning the son, Ronald, and now say he is being, quote, safeguarded. Investigators say without explanation that they now feel young DeFeo was in the house at the time of the murders, but they're not yet considering him a suspect. And so forth.
We have no suspect at this time. We have no indication of the motive at this time.
What about Ronald DeFeo, the son, the surviving son?
Ronald is being safeguarded by the Suffolk County Police at this time.
Why safeguarded?
Why? Because the six members of the family are dead, and we don't know why, and he's the sole remaining member.
Is he also a suspect?
He's not a suspect at this time.
Few people in the neighborhood knew the family well, but those who did described them as close-knit.
Well, I think they were just very sweet, very religious people, very family-minded people. And that's about all I could say. Very good, very generous, this type. Very close with their children.
There's one element in the usual mass murder story which seems to be missing from this case. There's no sense of fear in this community. No feeling of a mass murderer on the loose. People we talk to seem to feel that whatever was the motive for this crime, it had something to do with the family. It's not something that's going to return to bother anyone else. In Amityville, Long Island, Phil Barno, News Center 4.
Suffolk County Detectives Gerald Gazaloff and Joseph Napolitano began questioning the men who had found the bodies, and also the neighbours. Ronnie was asked to provide an immediate written statement before being taken away from the scene. It's worth noting that at this point Ronnie wrote in his statement that he had been home the previous night until sometime after 4:40 a.m. He said that he saw the wheelchair that his brother Mark was using due to his football injury outside of the bathroom door when he left for work. He also heard him flushing the toilet inside, so he knew that he was alive as he left. Suffolk County ballistics expert Detective Alfred Della Penna arrived at the scene and was greeted by Deputy Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Howard C. Edelman, who whispered to him as he pushed through the gathering spectators outside of the house. "Hi Al, we've got six big ones for you this time." Della Penna earned a Master of Science degree in police science, and he was the head of the Major Immediate Incident Crime Scene Unit in Suffolk County. Della Penna had extensive training in firearms and was, by all accounts, a very experienced firearms expert. Della Penna was looking for clues to ascertain if the family had been sedated or poisoned before the shootings. As I previously mentioned, the police immediately thought the scene strange, and they didn't understand why none of the victims awoke once the shooting started. There was no indication that any of the six victims had moved an inch, had awoken, or anything at all, which was outright bizarre, the investigating officers thought. In its initial reports, the New York Times actually reported that the family had all been drugged or sedated prior to the murder, but that didn't appear in any subsequent reports or articles. Due to this misreporting, it's a myth that has been repeated many times over the years. You'll see a lot of that in this case. Officers searched diligently for the murder weapon, looking extensively throughout the house, both inside and out, and they also searched the Amityville Creek to the rear. They searched garbage cans down the entire block and neighboring blocks, and searched the family's swimming pool. No murder weapon was found. There were no bullet cartridge casings found at the scene either, so it had been swept by the shooter. The size of the wounds on the victims' bodies indicated that the bullets had passed through the bodies. But at this stage, they couldn't turn the bodies to check, but it was a clear, high-powered rifle that had been used in the murders. All that aside, the police actually recovered a number of weapons from the DeFeo house. Namely, a Crossman .38 target pellet revolver from a closet in the master bedroom, a starter pistol from a kitchen drawer, a Crossman .22 caliber pellet rifle found mounted on the wall, a Healthways Plainsman pistol in the dresser drawer in the master bedroom, a Marlin .22 caliber rifle discovered in the third floor west side bedroom, and an Ithaca 12-gauge shotgun removed from a secure gun cabinet in a ground floor closet. Suffolk County Chief Detective Patrick Mellon told the gathering press outside of the house, quote, "None of the guns recovered had been used in a long time," unquote. A number of police officers have stated that the crime scene was so eerie that officers whispered when they spoke because they were so spooked. Something felt very wrong in that house, they felt. There were further questions about the crime scene that puzzled the police from the very start. Why hadn't the DeFeo family dog Shaggy protected the family? He was a watchdog, and according to several neighbors, many were afraid to go into the house with Shaggy running loose. Deputy Suffolk County Police Commissioner Robert C. Rapp declared,
"We have no suspect at this time. We have no indication of the motive at this time."
Once again, all of the family members were found laying face down with their hands extended above their heads in a ritualistic fashion. Police questioned friends and neighbors of the family. In total, more than 80 people would be questioned in the immediate hours after the discovery of the bodies. Several stories quickly emerged of Ronnie's bragging to people that his father was quote-unquote big in the mafia. Ronald DeFeo Sr. too bragged of his organized crime connections, neighbors reported. Many were reluctant to reveal too much information about the family's mob ties, for obvious reasons. Ronald DeFeo Sr.'s father, Joseph Rocco DeFeo, reportedly had mob ties, but it was Rocco's brother, Peter DeFeo, who was a known mafioso soldier. Chief James Caples of the Suffolk County Organized Crime Bureau investigated the possibility of a mob hit, particularly because Ronnie had also alleged that mafia hitman Tony Mazzeo was responsible for the murders. The Organized Crime Bureau would quickly establish, from their underworld sources, that Peter DeFeo was a captain in the Genovese crime family and one of Genovese's closest associates. Although the investigating officers considered the possibility of a revenge hit against Peter or Peter himself being a suspect in the crime, Police eventually found evidence to disregard both possibilities in the form of alibis and underworld informants. Back at the temporary crime scene HQ in the Rufus Island home, Detective Greco approached Mindy, Ronnie's girlfriend, who had shown up concerned about Ronnie, who had missed their date. Mindy introduced herself to Greco, and the two began speaking about Ronnie and the day's events. Mindy was interrupted by a man named Richard Weisling, who claimed to be Ronnie's attorney, handing her a business card and asked her to call him if she had any questions. Bobby Kelski and Ronnie were in the living room being interrogated together. Detectives initially questioned Ronnie and Bobby together, along with Reverend James McNamara, the family priest who had arrived at the scene to support Ronnie. Bobby was quickly asked to wait in another room, however, with the police aiming to divide and conquer. It seemed to work. Ronnie's story was falling apart. Detectives Randazzo and Gazaloff turned up the heat and hit Ronnie with harder questions and put more pressure on him, letting Ronnie talk himself into a corner. What happened next hurt Ronnie in the eyes of the police, certainly not doing himself any favours. Detective Gazaloff asked Ronnie abruptly, "Who killed your family?" But Ronnie just stared into space and didn't answer. Gazaloff then told Ronnie that they were going to the police station, to which Ronnie flatly refused. Detective Gazaloff demanded. The two began to argue and Ronnie stood up as if he was going to leave. Detective Gazaloff pushed Ronnie's face and Ronnie fell to the ground, not expecting the detective to be physical with him. Ronnie sprang back to his feet. Detective Gazaloff took a step back, opened his coat and unsnapped the strap on his holster, placing his hand firmly on his gun, ready to draw. He waited for Ronnie's next move, but Ronnie just sat back down. Gazaloff told Ronnie, quote-unquote, "It'll be better down the police station. All I want you to do is give a statement, and then I'll bring you right back." Ronnie eventually agreed and decided to cooperate with the police. At approximately 8 p.m, Ronnie was escorted by police out of the Ireland home and into a police car, a visible red mark on his face where Detective Gazaloff had assaulted him. Eyewitnesses said Ronnie's eyes were filled with tears, but he remained silent with his head bowed. Ronnie's grandfather, Rocco DeFeo, asked Bobby to see where the police were taking him. But when Bobby asked the officers escorting Ronnie where they were heading, an officer shouted in Bobby's face, quote-unquote, "Get away," with the officer placing his hand in Bobby's face. "Don't worry about it," the officer added. Something seemed off, Bobby thought. Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt this episode. We'll get right back into it in a second. I just wanted to remind you all that we have a Patreon. Over there you can get access to additional episodes, investigation research, articles, blogs, and a bunch of other stuff. It costs just $2 a month, which is an insane bargain and less than the cost of a cup of coffee. You get so much for that price, not to mention you'd be helping us out too. If you want to join us over there, head over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We hope to see you guys there. Now, back to the show. Detective Gazaloff took Ronnie to the first precinct on 109 in Lindenhurst. Side note, Ronnie was actually taken to Amityville Police Station first, but they weren't allowed to hold him there. Anyway, at Lindenhurst, Ronnie was questioned further and a paraffin test was performed on him at approximately 9 p.m. This test would establish if Ronnie had fired a gun in the previous hours. Ronnie asked for an attorney. He wanted to call Richard Hartman, an attorney who had previously represented him. Detective Gazaloff said to him, quote, "Don't worry about it. You'll get an attorney. We'll get you one." Unquote. Gazaloff kept saying that they'd let him call an attorney, but they never did. Paraffin tests were done on several people that night, 11 to be exact, including the 6 dead bodies and Bobby Kelski, as confirmed by Assistant District Attorney for Suffolk County, Gerald Sullivan. At 12 a.m. that night, Ronnie signed an 8-page statement for police. Within the document, Ronnie repeated that his family had mob ties and that he presumed his family were killed in a mob-related hit. At the exact same time, back at the DeFeo house, the bodies of the 6 murdered family members were being removed from the house in black body bags to be transported to the county morgue in Hopage. During the removal of the body of Mark DeFeo fell off the gurney that was being used to remove the bodies from the house, and the gathered crowd gasped at the sight of an 11-year-old deceased boy covered in blood with a huge bullet hole in his back. Bobby Kelski, during his police interrogation, told police that Ronnie owned several guns and was a complete gun nut. He also informed officers that Ron Sr. had taken the guns away from Ronnie recently, but Ronnie had got them back somehow. Kelski was eventually released by police with no charges after they were satisfied that his version of events from that night were accurate. Meanwhile, once the bodies were removed from the house, Della Penna could begin examining the mattresses. In John Matthews' mattress, Della Penna found a shell casing that he identified as being from a .35 caliber rifle. In a complete coincidence, Stephen Hicks, a close personal friend of Ronnie, called the police to offer assistance. Hicks told police that Ronnie had recently bought a new .35 caliber Marlin rifle, and he'd brought it over to his house. Hicks continued that when Ronnie came over, he accidentally fired the weapon in his living room, leaving a bullet lodged in the hardwood floor. Della Penna naturally paid Hicks a visit to retrieve the bullet and ran tests in order to ascertain if it was a match to the bullets used in the murders. You have to ask what kind of friend Stephen Hicks was to Ronnie. Considering they were close, Hicks essentially dropped Ronnie right in a heap of mess. Maybe he just wanted to do the right thing. Who knows? Della Penna also wanted to determine the gun used in the murders was the same gun sold to Ronnie by Chuck Tewksbury a few weeks prior. On a side note, 5 separate neighbours stated in evidence given to police that they were awakened by the DeFeo's dog at around 2:30 a.m. It was barking intensely and seemed agitated. None of the neighbours, however, decided to check what was happening or investigate further. Even though the dog's barking could be heard, none of the neighbours reported hearing any gunshots fired. This is particularly strange given how a .35 Marlin is an extremely loud gun. It would have been heard halfway down the street. It was a damn cowboy rifle. It has been speculated that maybe none of the neighbours wanted to say that they heard the shots for fear of getting involved in a case that could potentially involve the mob. It certainly was baffling how no one heard the shots, the police thought, and they were entirely confused. The police began to seriously consider the possibility that the family may have been drugged. This is likely why the Times originally made the claim in their first article, then made no further mention of it once it was verified that the bodies had no traces of drugs in their systems. Referring back to Della Penna, he eventually did verify that the bullet in Stephen Hicks' floor that Ronnie had fired accidentally was the exact match to the bullet used in the DeFeo murders. The police now had hard evidence of Ronnie's involvement in the crime. This also answered a burning question that the police had been pondering, that being where Ronnie was during the murders, and if the family were drugged, then why wasn't he? As I said though, the family were established to not have been drugged. Some versions of the DeFeo murders story you will read online will say that they were all drugged. This is categorically and entirely not true. There will be several other falsehoods that I will dispel in this series. Anyway, I digress. Police, while interviewing neighbours, quickly began to hear reports against Ronnie. Many felt that Ronnie was, quote, bad news and an extremely unsavoury character. Indeed, when the detectives checked Ronnie's official record, they found that, in September 1973, Ronnie was convicted of grand larceny. In December 1973, Ronnie was sentenced to 1 year of probation. In April 1974, Ronnie's then-girlfriend contacted police and informed them of Ronnie's out-of-control drug use. Probation officers conducted an examination on Ronnie and found fresh needle marks in his arms. In May 1974, Judge Harry E. Seidel ordered random drug testing on Ronnie. Between June and October, urine tests showed traces of quinine, which is frequently used in heroin. Ronnie was also the main suspect in the recent robbery of $21,000 in cash from his grandfather's car dealership in Brooklyn. At 8:45 a.m. on November the 14th, Ronnie DeFeo was formally arrested for the murder of his six family members. At 6:45 p.m. on November the 14th, Suffolk County Deputy Commissioner Robert C. Rapp, sitting alongside Chief Mellon, announced the arrest of Ronald DeFeo Jr. in a press conference. The DeFeo family had been dead since at least 7 a.m. on the morning of November 13th, the police also announced, following examination of the corpses. No motive was given for the crime, but newspapers and television media were reporting that the motive was likely money, as Ronnie was now the sole beneficiary of the family's substantial estate and also of a $200,000 life insurance policy. Further evidence was found by police that also implicated Ronnie. When they searched his room, they found a pair of long rectangular cardboard boxes labelled Marlin rifles, .22 and .35. The .35 rifle was missing from the box, however. Another piece of evidence that helped the police in their investigation against Ronnie was when next-door neighbour Mrs. Namath was questioned by police during their door-to-door checks. She recalled that her son had heard the DeFeo's dog howling wildly at 3:20 a.m. on the night of the murders. Other neighbours had reported hearing the dog at 2:30 a.m. From this, the police were able to narrow down the time of the crime. Detectives deduced that the murders occurred around 3 a.m. Ronnie stated that he had left for work that morning at around 4:40 a.m. This placed Ronnie at the scene of the crime at the time the murders took place, and made Ronnie the only person in the house who was present and survived. Ronnie finally broke down and confessed to the murders on November the 14th after a day of interrogation. Detective Harrison stated that during Ronnie's confession, he said, quote, "I took the rifle and ammunition from my room, and then I shot my brother Mark like this." Detective Harrison said Ronnie stood up and acted out the killing in front of him. During his confession, Ronnie also said that after he shot his brother Mark, he watched the boy's body twitch and convulse until he was dead. Whilst Ronnie's story would change regularly and has done many times over the years, the police were able to establish where he dumped some of the vital evidence. He said that he placed the shell casings, bloody clothes, and some other items in a pillowcase and threw them in a storm drain on the way to his workplace. Due to Ronnie's precise directions, detectives recovered the following evidence: a rifle carrying case, all eight spent shell casings from the scene of the murder, and bloodstained clothing matching the victim's blood group. Police also recovered the Marlin rifle from the Amityville River at the end of the Richmond Avenue dock. Again, this was from precise instructions given to them from Ronnie. The Amityville police and Suffolk County investigators now had their man. On Sunday, November the 18th, just 5 days after the murders had taken place, family, friends and neighbours, and well-wishers, gathered at St. Martin's of Tours Catholic Church in Amityville for the funeral of the six slain DeFeo family members. The church was full to capacity, with many others standing outside to pay their last respects. Due to the notoriety and interest the case had gotten in the press, many who didn't even know the family came from far and wide to attend the ceremony. St. Martin of Tours, the church which has stood in the same spot on Union Avenue since it was erected in 1897. At its front are three large white double doors separated by huge stone pillars. As you enter the church, the walls are lined with red, yellow, and green mosaics that depict biblical scenes. The church pews are painted white with oak seating. Large, colorful, stained glass windows adorn each side of the church walls, where light streams through onto the ornate chandeliers within. But that autumnal day in 1974, the air was still and the crowds gathered outside were silent as six coffins were slowly and respectfully taken inside and lined up neatly in front of the center of the church. The funeral took place right across the street from the elementary school where the youngest DeFeo children attended each day. Six coffins, all from the same family, on the same day is almost unheard of, and something like this was unprecedented in the small town of Amityville. The community was in shock. Inside the church, people stood shoulder to shoulder, packed into the hall. The police wouldn't let Ronnie attend the funeral that day. They stated it was for his own protection, but in reality, they wanted to keep him away from his surviving family members, one of whom was an attorney. You see, back in 1974, Suffolk County Police were being investigated for serious malpractice and unlawful activities. A Newsday article at the time stated officers were regularly engaging in suspect intimidation and torture, illegal activities, taking bribes, and numerous other illegalities. And this case was no different. Ronnie was allegedly beaten and tortured during questioning. He was denied food and water and also the use of toilet facilities. As well as beatings to the face and torso, Ronnie was allegedly subjected to a torture method where they would place a phone book on top of his head, then whack the top of the book with a bat. During questioning and the early stages of the investigation, Ronnie was also kept away from a lawyer and not allowed to make any phone calls in a direct breach of his constitutional rights. Bobby Kelski also alleges that he was subjected to similar measures. The Suffolk County Police strenuously deny these allegations and have publicly stated that no physical violence, beatings, torture or intimidation were used against Ronnie DeFeo. Ronnie alleges otherwise. It's hard to know who is telling the truth here. Ronnie's trial began on October the 14th of 1975. He was represented by attorney William Weber. Remember that name? We'll hear from him again in the next episode. Ronnie and Weber submitted a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. Quite simply, Ronnie stated that he had no actual memory of killing any of his family members. He stated that due to psychological disorders and heavy drug taking, namely heroin and LSD, he was too out of it to know or control what he was doing. Dr. Daniel Schwartz, who is a psychiatrist for the defense, entirely supported this notion. The prosecution, however, had a hard time accepting this claim. If Ronnie had no memory of the crimes and no control over what he was doing, how could he provide detailed recollection that led investigators to the murder weapons and the clothes that he disposed of that night? How was he able to drive a car to work just an hour after he committed the murders? How was he able to recall and explain in detail the murder of his brother Mark to prosecutors and detail how he watched his legs and feet twitch and his body convulse until he was dead? Indeed, Gerard Sullivan, the assistant Suffolk County District Attorney who was prosecuting, and Dr. Harold Zolan, the psychiatrist for the prosecution, completely refuted Ronnie's claims. Zolan, under oath, asserted that yes, Ronnie may have been an abuser of heroin and LSD, and no doubt he suffered from antisocial personality disorder. But none of these things would have made Ronnie unable to control or remember his actions that night. Zolan asserted that Ronnie was absolutely culpable and made conscious choices that night. When testifying on his own behalf, Ronnie once again admitted to the slayings, saying at one point, quote unquote, "I couldn't care less what happens to me or the rest of my life." Ultimately, after 2 days of deliberation, the jury of six men and six women sided with the prosecution. The trial lasted 7 weeks, and at that time was the longest trial in Suffolk County history. On the 21st of November 1975, Ronald DeFeo Jr. was found guilty on all six counts of second-degree murder. He was sentenced by Judge Thomas Stark on the 4th of December 1975 to six sentences of 25 years to life in prison. Judge Stark, on sentencing Ronnie, stated, quote, "Your crimes are the most heinous murders committed in Suffolk County since its founding." Ronnie DeFeo was imprisoned at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, New York. All of his appeals and requests for parole throughout the years were denied. Whilst this all seems to be tied up with finality, there remained a number of questions. Strange questions, and also significant anomalies in the case that still don't make sense. All of the victims were found face down in their beds with no signs of a struggle or any movement. There was also no evidence of sedatives or any other drugs having been administered to them prior to their deaths. Even though Ronnie did claim during his initial interrogation that he had drugged his family. The autopsies proved this to be false, and it wouldn't be the first or last time that Ronnie's story would change. In fact, in the years since his arrest, Ronnie has changed his version of events that night more than a dozen times. So why didn't any of the family wake up once Ronnie started firing the gun? A very loud gun, at that. Police were able to prove that no silencer was used on the weapon, so it begs the question, did Ronnie have any help with the murders? Additionally, what was the motive for the crimes? During questioning, Ronnie asked detectives how he would go about claiming his father's life insurance policy, a policy valued at around $200,000. Understandably, this set off alarm bells with the prosecution, which prompted them to suggest at trial that Ronnie's motive was to collect all of the life insurance policies of his parents. In a Newsday article from 1986, Ronnie stated that his sister Dawn actually killed their father, and because of this, his distraught mother then killed all of his siblings with a rifle before Ronnie then killed his mother. This seems a stretch, given how Ronnie has also stated that his mother Louise was a devoted mother and wife and always sided with her husband even when he beat her. In another interview from prison, Ronnie also stated that his sister committed all the killings before he snapped at her and accidentally shot her in a struggle. Ronnie has also claimed that he took the blame for the killings for fear the mafia would kill him if he didn't. He also claimed that his body committed the murders while possessed by the devil, though he had no consciousness or control over his actions. The 2002 book titled The Night the DeFeos Died, Reinvestigating the Amityville Murders, written by author Rick Osuna, goes over all of the irregularities surrounding the case. Osuna is considered by many to be one of the foremost experts on the DeFeo murders due to his extensive research and time spent talking with Ronnie DeFeo. But personally, I find Osuna a bit of a Ronnie DeFeo apologist, so I won't quote him too heavily here. Osuna has for years advocated for the case to be reopened. His goal was to establish Ronnie DeFeo's true involvement in the killing of his family and to identify others who may have been involved. In his conclusions, Osuna maintains that Ronnie killed his parents, Ronald and Louise DeFeo, with the help of a friend, but that his younger siblings were killed by his 18-year-old sister Dawn, who was then shot by Ronnie after he witnessed the atrocity. Quote, "I think that Dawn was involved, and simply saying so makes me sad, because we are talking about a girl ready to do anything, to get out of the house and escape from her parents." Osuna says in a 2022 interview with journalist Jamie Lorite. The author is referring to the affidavit I spoke about in the previous episode, written by Dawn's boyfriend, William Davidge. Dawn wanted to move to Florida with him despite the disapproval of her parents. In fact, The night before the murders, there was allegedly a blazing row between Dawn and her father about her wanting to go to Florida. I say alleged, as this information has come from Ronnie's mouth, so take that how you will. Rick Osuna believes Ronnie, however. During the alleged argument, Osuna says, Ronald DeFeo Sr. attacked his wife and several of his children, leaving his youngest child, 9-year-old John Matthew, with a bloodied face after he punched the child in the heat of the moment. Dawn, for her part, tried to defend herself with a large kitchen knife. But following this, Dawn, convinced that her father would kill them all if they did not act first, she persuaded her older brother Ronnie to kill Ronald Sr. during the night. She also encourages him to kill their mother Louise too, who, despite also being a victim of Big Ron's abuse, is seen by Dawn as beyond hope and a lost cause, as she was always unconditionally on Big Ron's side. What they don't agree on is their younger siblings, however. Ronnie instructs Dawn to watch their bedrooms while he and his friend Bobby Kelski execute Ronald and Louise. Dawn argues that they can't leave any witnesses, and that it would be a shame for the younger children to grow up with such trauma. So she decides to kill all three of them. Ronnie is apparently horrified by what she has done and tries to take the rifle from her, accidentally shooting her in the process. This is the version of events fed to author Rick Osuna by Ronnie DeFeo. In all fairness, Rick Osuna's book is well researched and provides a wealth of documentation and evidence. He unfortunately, at least for me, relies too much on the word of a proven liar to arrive at his conclusions. If Dawn was so upset that her father wouldn't let her move to Florida, why would she kill him? Why wouldn't she just run away to Florida? Is it really that caring of Dawn to kill her younger brothers and sister just to spare them the trauma of losing their parents? Don't we all lose our parents at some point? The picture of Dawn, portrayed by Ronnie and Rick Osuna, also does not match the image of her described by friends and family, people who actually knew her and remember her. The final point which I'll make about Rick Osuna's book, which is considered the best account there is of the crimes, is that Osuna maintains that the confession of Ronnie DeFeo, who is an alcoholic and heroin addict, he makes a point to emphasize, was obtained under torture. You know, this may well have been the case, or may not. The various judges involved in the trial process over the decades have all rejected all evidence to that effect. But that aside, Ronnie has confessed to the crimes many times over the years since he has been in prison, and not always under duress or the influence of substances. The only thing that has changed in Ronnie's version of events is how it happened. He has never recanted the fact that he was the killer. That said, take this on board. The prosecutor and the Amityville police admitted on several occasions throughout the 1980s and 90s that the crime would have required three people to realistically commit. Another independent investigation by retired police detective Herman Race reached the same conclusion. So is Rick Osuna's hypothesis possible, do you think? What do you think is the most likely series of events that night? But wait, there's more. In 1990, Ronald filed a 440 motion to have his conviction overturned. In support of his motion, Ronnie asserted that Dawn and an unknown assailant who subsequently fled the house before he could get a good look at him had actually killed his parents, and then Dawn subsequently killed her younger brothers and sister. The 440 motion didn't clarify why Dawn would have done this in the aftermath of a murder by persons unknown. The only person Ronnie killed, he said at the time, was Dawn, and that it was by accident as they struggled over the rifle. Judge Thomas Stark denied the motion. In another bizarre series of events, Ronnie also asserted he was married at the time of the murders to a woman named Geraldine Gates, with whom he was living in New Jersey. On the night of the murders, his mother phoned to ask him to come home to break up a fight between Dawn and his father. Geraldine's house was around 90 miles away, he claimed, which seems a bit far to travel to break up a fight that was going on at that minute. Ronnie subsequently drove to Amityville with Geraldine's brother, Richard Romando, who would verify this entire story, Ronnie said. No Richard Romando could be traced by the courts, however. Evidence was submitted to the court by the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office suggesting that Richard Romando did not exist and that Geraldine Gates was living in upstate New York, married to someone else at the time of the murders. In 1992, the District Attorney's Office secured a statement under oath where Geraldine Gates admitted that her brother, Romando, was fictitious and that she did not actually marry Ronnie until 1989 in a prison ceremony. Following the circus of ever-changing accounts on the night in question, Judge Stark released the following lengthy statement. Quote,
I find the testimony of the defendant overall to be false and fabricated. His testimony that during the fall of 1974, he was married and lived with his wife and child at Long Branch, New Jersey, is incredible and not worthy of belief. He produced no corroborating evidence in this regard. Another reason for my disbelief of defendant's testimony is demonstrated by consideration of several portions of the trial testimony. He signed a lengthy written statement describing in detail his activities. In this statement, he said that he lived with his family at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, and that he worked for his father, that he usually went to and from work with his father, that he was ill and stayed home from work on November 12, 1974, that he was on probation for having stolen an outboard engine and had an appointment to see his probation officer in Amityville on that very afternoon. The defendant's girlfriend, Mindy Weiss, testified that she began dating the defendant in June 1974 and was with him frequently that summer and fall. The defendant's testimony that he did not shoot and kill the members of his family is likewise incredible and not worthy of belief.
Author Rick Asuna met with Ronnie on November 30th, 2000, prison records show. According to Asuna, they spoke for about 6 hours. Asuna refers to Ronnie as Butch. However, Ronnie later denied giving Rick Asuna any information for his book. Further, in an interview Ronnie gave to the Lou Gentile radio show, Ronnie claimed that he immediately left the interview and did not speak to Asuna about anything substantive. Who do you believe in all of this? Ronald DeFeo Jr. died at the Albany Medical Center on March 12, 2021, at the age of 69. The United States Prison Service has not released his cause of death to the public. In the next episode...
The murders took place in this house. 1 year later, George and Kathleen Lutz bought the house and they moved into it with their three children. After living there for 28 days, they were convinced the house was possessed by some kind of evil force, and they left their belongings and they fled, and they were really terrified.